Before we move on, Laura and I, this has been a really incredible day and a half for us because we've been, a number of us have been working on this for months, and it's wonderful. And I cannot believe the energy of this group, that everybody is still going at this point. And I have the feeling that there is a lot to talk about in this space right now. There's been a lot of things raised, and we needed a space to process. So we're going to do that. I'd like to invite our closing panelists up, and that is Chad and Elaine and Jim Bear and Pastor Jen. Sharon Day had a prior commitment, so she could not be with us tonight, but she sends her gratitude for her time here. I know it. We had a wonderful workshop with her as well, so do continue to follow her work also. But I just want to first invite you to sit in a half circle here with this panel, and we want to open it up a little bit for reflection, a space to process all that has been shared. It's been a lot. It's hard to believe that the plenary with Pastor Jen and Jim Bear and Bob was just last night. It feels like a few days ago. There's been so much that has been shared and talked about. But first, to hear what's on the hearts and minds of those on the plenary and those who have been sharing as you've shared, as you've listened, as you have engaged the folks who are here, just a few opening thoughts and engagement with each other. But then especially a chance, because we haven't had a Q&A yet, an extended one, a chance for everybody here to share some thoughts, to share what you're struggling with. And if you just have a brief comment you'd like to share with the group, that doesn't require a response, please do. But if you have a question that you're wrestling with that you would like our panel to talk about and the folks here gathered, please do that as well. So we will move to that time quickly. But first, Pastor Jen, Pastor Jim Bear, Elaine, and Chad, what is on your mind right now about this theme, re-inhabiting the Mississippi watershed? And I'm wondering if I could start first with Pastor Jim Bear, if he would share a few thoughts, and then maybe if the rest of you could engage and have a conversation for a few minutes. And then when you're ready, feel free to turn it back to the folks here. And if you want to ask them a question, please do. Otherwise, we'll just open up for them.
So many things are going through my mind right now. Sierra really just created a different space in here just now. I've been so proud of this church for my short 3 years that I've been here, and I get more and more proud when other indigenous people come into this sanctuary and feel the welcome. Because I would challenge that in most of your congregations, as you leave this place, they would not feel that same welcome. And that's just the truth. My apologies for putting it so bluntly. I've had an observation over the last 48 hours. I have had quite a number of women come and talk to me and explore thoughts that are ruminating in their minds, and it has been wonderful. But it's been mostly, predominantly women. And I was thinking, what's happening? What's going on? Because I talk all over the cities, all over the states, and after every time I talk, people come up to me, and I've never noticed that in any other setting other than these last 48 hours that it's been predominantly women. And I think what's happening is maybe for the first time you are recognizing, as we emphasize the mother force, that is earth, the divine feminine, that is river, life-giving, your feeling, a liberation, an empowering, and nothing in your theological education to this point gives space for that. And so when it's presented to you through song and dance, through ceremony to welcome the sun, through drumming, when it's presented to you, you have to speak about these things. I've been asked the same question by four different women here because something's awakening in them. And it's beautiful. I must admit, when I heard the title of this conference, I was skeptical. Re-inhabiting the Mississippi is itself kind of an arrogant assumption, right? When I heard that Ched and Elaine were going to be partners, I was skeptical. Not because of anything they've done to deserve my skepticism, but because as a Native person, I have been conditioned to be skeptical when white people are interested in Indian stuff. We, the people of this land, we know the difference between white people who learn about Indians and white people who learn from Indians. And I had not had a relationship with Elaine or Ched. I didn't know them. My apologies, I haven't read your books. So I had this skepticism. And over the last 48 hours, it has become clear through their words, through their hearts, through our spirits, finding understanding in each other, that these people, though they are white, have learned from Indians and not just about Indians. And there is a world of difference. You can learn about Indians all you want and never grasp at the wisdom that comes from heart connecting to heart, from story intersecting story. My appreciation for that. As a pastor on staff, again, I want to reiterate welcome and thank you to Jay and Tevin. I will admit skepticism when I said, oh, we're bringing in a dance troupe, performance artists. As I shared earlier this morning, I was so moved. And I spoke with Jay about it a little bit afterwards, and I said, my reaction wasn't the reaction you were going for. You sing a spiritual like Wade in the Water, and everybody in the room jumps up and claps and enters celebration. And there's one sad soul in the back, openly weeping. And he said to me, he said, but you taught me that that is possible. That because story is alive in space and not dead in time, joy and lament can occupy the same space. Joy and lament can occupy the same heart because story is alive. So my thank you and gratitude to my Indigenous brothers and sisters, Sierra, Brian John, I don't know if Bill is still here, Donnie Begay, is here. My apologies to anyone whom I may be missing. Bob Klanderud, of course, always has my deepest gratitude. He had to leave, unfortunately, for this evening. As a pastor on this church, I give you welcome any time you want to come through these doors. Any time you are welcome to share worship with us. And know that this is a safe space. This is a place where your story is celebrated, is revered, is not only appreciated, but is needed. We recognize, this man recognizes the need of those indigenous stories. Thank you to my indigenous sisters and brothers, to my family at Church of All Nations. Deepest thanks to my colleague, friend, mentor, Pastor Jin. The welcome I have felt here for the last 3 years, the safety to be myself. You don't know how rare that is because you just live it, but it's not found other places. All these things ruminate in my heart. All these observances I've made. Most of you aren't aware, but this afternoon, while you were all in workshop, I admit a fair amount of fatigue and didn't think I would make it through a workshop. So I sat outside and just enjoyed conversation with a very dear friend. And while you were all in workshop, a juvenile bald eagle came up, swooped over the church, and went out over the lake. That means something. That means something. This morning at pipe ceremony, we had an eagle visit. That means something. It's the spirit validating the work that we do. It is the spirit recognizing that we recognize the story of this space and saying, here is a gift. Here is a messenger for you. In our language, we don't have a way of, when we say thank you, we say anishik. And it means with my deepest heartfelt gratitude. It's beyond thank you. You'll find that in Indian language. Most of our words are beyond what you have in English. So to Elaine, Ched, Pastor Jin, Jay, Tevin, my indigenous brothers and sisters, my Kan family, anishik.
You're welcome. I was speaking collectively. I'm Asian after all. It's like all of us. Thank you so much, Jim Bear, for such gracious words. One of the tremendous benefits of being an intentional multicultural congregation is that you open yourself up to all kinds of kinship. And Korean people have a really, really kind of a tight, intimate bond with one another, born out of our geography, kind of being squished together in this little tiny peninsula. All of North and South Korea would fit within the boundaries of Minnesota. Now, the state of Minnesota actually is larger than all of Korea. And also our history as oppressed people surrounded by great empires like China, Russia, and Japan. and later the British Empire and the American Empire and all of that. But we are also a very ethnocentric people. And part of what we try to do here at Church of All Nations is extend the spirit of hospitality and generosity and intimacy, which is so much the hallmark of Korean culture. And what would it look like to extend that outward and to try to offer that as a gift? And in offering that as a gift to the many, many cultures that are out there, then to incorporate people into this congregation and receive the gifts of human spirit and human touch and human wisdom and human feeling. And we have just incredible, amazing children of God here, like Pastor Jim Bear, who is a mentor of mine and whom I am so indebted to for the deepening of my own humanity. And a lot of us from Asia still have maintained some part of our humanity despite all the thousands of years of empire by being deeply connected to one another. Never, we don't even know what individualism is. It's not possible really to see ourselves as a separate entity apart from all the people around us. But we have increasingly lost touch with the other living creatures and increasingly with the land and our environment. And that's something that Jim Bear and many of our Native sisters and brothers here in North America still embody. So it's an incredible thing to be able to see and hear the natural world again, something that many of us in Asia have lost the ability to do. So I'm so grateful and honored to be a pastor here at this church. And I was just sharing with somebody over dinner that what it means to be at Church of All Nations is to just say stuff and then pick up the pieces after that, right? So I'm hearing, I'm seeing, I'm feeling, and then I reflect back what I'm experiencing from the congregation. And sometimes it's well-formed, and oftentimes it's not, and then I get corrected, and, you know, it gets reformulated, and then I try again to articulate the struggles, the longing, the hope of our community, and it keeps getting refined. And then soon, you know, sooner or later, it starts to have resonance with those outside the community. But whatever you're hearing from us, our words and concepts and dialogue and conversation that we've had 1,000 times back and forth, that then becomes an articulation of our entire community. So I'm the main thing for me, and where I intersect with so much of the work that many of you are involved in, is extending the concept of kinship without limit. And, you know, most people care about their immediate family. But what happens when we understand the entire Mississippi watershed, for those of us who live here, as our immediate family? That eagle that Jim Bear noticed this morning that I did not, as immediate family. What would happen to our life together if we extended the concept of family and kinship without limit? But it can't be done at the conceptual, intellectual level. We have to feel it. And that means that a lot of us who, through the forces of imperial oppression, have even lost touch with our own bodies, where there is a schizophrenic force at work where we cannot even feel the feelings in our own body, have to connect with that so that we can connect with other bodies and then non-human bodies and the water that flows through all our bodies. We said in our workshop that, you know, our body is a watershed too. 3/4 of the human body is water. And how do we take care of this watershed? Think about the pollution in our neoliberal world of the damage to this watershed. So caring about watershed from one body to the whole body politic, the body of Christ, the body of God's creation, then gives us a feeling of kinship that I think will really make this work of radical discipleship and radical stewardship endure.
What is coming up for me is the powerful moments of this weekend that I am so grateful for and that I found so transforming. And the sunrise service that you led, and then also the blessing with Sage. To be welcomed into that, and I know I told you, just feeling your love for us. Thank you. That is such a gift, to be loved across this settler-indigenous relationship where we are responsible and for so much harm. So I thank you for that. In your opening words, just naming some of the white people problems. I appreciate that. Because I don't know, us white folks, we need to do our own work. To have it cracked open like that, I appreciated that. And that grew out of our time. For me, with your staff and underground seminary students at the retreat, where there was such a level of sharing so intimately and vulnerably, we were, Chad and I were just welcomed into this true kinship, true family, and we were just brought in on that. And I thank you for that. That's the transforming stuff that we give to each other. And we have been a part of many different conversations around race. And oh my, we hurt each other. So much pain when we try to have these conversations. This has just been gift and has allowed us to be fully present who we are with our flaws and insecurities and vulnerabilities welcomed. Thank you. Thank you. Because that does not always happen. I want to give thanks to the folks that came to the workshop that I led. The work that you did in there, and again, sharing the impact of being settlers and the wrestling with learning our stories and intergenerational trauma. And I just appreciate the table that was set here so that we could all get really deep, really fast, and do good work together. And Jay and Tevin, I love you. Thank you.
Well, we got a regular love fest going on here, don't we? Isn't it great? First of all, I want to thank all y'all for sticking around all day. Long day. You're still here, ready to dance and sing and have a love fest. That's testimony to all of you, as well as to the organizers and the hospitality of this space. Let's face it, folks, we all go to a lot of conferences, right? We do. We go to, you know, talk fests and performances and all the rest of it. And quite frankly, there's a lot of strip mining that goes on at conferences. The performers are there to build their egos or careers, and the participants are there to get something, and you know, it happens, right? It happens at church too. Folks are going to get something. And then there's those moments that happen every once in a while when folk are actually there to turn a corner, to get born again. Or maybe the metaphor often that comes up for me is it feels a little bit sometimes like that family meeting that you have when you get the terminal diagnosis. When suddenly the masks have to fall and you have to talk about shit for real. And you have to live differently in light of the terminal diagnosis. And hope is no longer gratuitous. It's costly. We have to have those kinds of family meetings. And we have to figure out how to create the space for those family meetings. But we're not very good at it, particularly out of white culture. And I think that the hospitality and leadership of our elder brothers and sisters, but also the goodwill of everybody coming to this family meeting saying, okay, what needs to change? What needs to deepen? There has been that quality here that has really worked for me. This has been a great space, and I do a fair bit of this, as do many of you, and there has been a quality here that I want to commend everyone for your participation in. And having given my two cents on that, I'm very interested to find out what worked for you. And I know the organizers would appreciate that, and we are all organizers. So I'm also interested in the task of how do we curate these spaces, friends, wherever we are. This should be the rule, not the exception. We know we're not there. But how can we explore this? How can we model this? So look at that. There's a lonely microphone sitting right there in the middle of the aisle. To start the dialogue, could a couple of you maybe just say, hey, this is what worked for me over the last 24 hours. This is what connected, and this is why. Because that will help us understand how to curate these spaces. Does that make sense? Folk can just kind of line up and, you know, be like testifying.
Hi, Lindsay, Airy, Detroit River Watershed. What worked for me was the Love Fest that you named. And I think just the Sacred Sites tour set the tone for me, and from what I've talked to other people, for a lot of people, of just giving permission to, one, to be able to get to hear the stories of this place, and to let it break us open. I've just found myself through performances and so many of the things that have been named here, just like crying most of the last 48 hours. And I was crying too during Wade in the Water, and then everyone got up and was clapping, and I was like, oh no, I should be clapping. I think in the world that I'm in peace and justice activism in Detroit right now, it feels like survival mode a lot, and can get caught up in what we're up against a lot. And then there's a lot of talk about, we need spirit to infuse this, we need spirit to infuse this, but there aren't a lot of spaces for that. Charity Hicks is a name that I know some people here know, and I never knew her, but her spirit is invoked a lot as kind of the martyr of the water struggle, and she was killed last summer in New York after resisting her own water shutoff. And then the leader of my organization, We the People of Detroit, Monica Lewis Patrick, who is now one of the foremost leaders of the water struggle in Detroit, named at a conference that some of us were at recently how one of her huge regrets was that she did not know Charity. They organized together, they knew each other's politics, but she never knew Charity. This place has been a gift in a lot of ways to help help me grieve and to imagine with all of you and be welcomed into a space that's completely, I don't know. And I feel like now I have the gift of knowing a little bit more thanks to the Love Fest. So that's what's worked for me.
Yeah, Amy Van Steenwick from here in Minneapolis. I just had to get up and comment because what was really palpable to me that I feel like is almost always missing, and I really don't enjoy conferences for the most part, but was the fact that almost like the majority of the people who were speaking here, or I guess at least you guys that are up there, I knew that going into it, coming into it, you had already spent all this time together. People were not just like bopping in and out and speaking into an area that they didn't have any particular connection to, or speaking back to back against, you know, somebody that they weren't kind of interacting with. And so all of that pre-retreat stuff, and this is what I think like Tevin and Jay, as you guys were presenting too about when you do, you know, your month-long intensives, but then beforehand you guys are on retreat together for a while and you're doing all this inner work together. Like, that's really hard for somebody who, you know, might travel around and speak at various conferences, but I feel like for myself, if I were in that position, I would hesitate to speak somewhere unless there was, like, a good pre-piece, you know, bringing that depth. So. That's a good word.
My name is Luciano Kovac. I'm the North American Regional Secretary for the World Student Christian Federation, and I'm here because Underground Seminary is one of the chapters of the student Christian movement in the U.S. When I was invited, I felt that this was going to be such an important moment, not just to make connections with the students, but also for the theme, because the WSCF North America has decided that racism, coloniality, and right relations is going to be one of the most important topics for our reflection in the next few years. So I want to thank you all for this wonderful conference. And what has worked for me has been that each of you, each of the person who's been up there or in the workshops has shown vulnerability and the ability to come together without fear to show the wounds, without the fear to show weakness, and this is a strength to be able to, you know, to show pain and to say we have to do the work together. So the fact that people are coming together to do this painful work has really resonated with me in this conference. In 1992, I'm going to share just a little personal story, but in 1992, as part of my commitment and you know, social justice activism, in my country of origin, Italy, I, as part of the work that my student Christian movement did, was that we took to the streets to, as part of the movement that was countering and objecting to the celebration of the discovery, and so we said, you know, we were totally listening to the stories that were coming from North America, from the indigenous people, and not only from North America, from indigenous people from all over the world, the Philippines and other countries who were challenging the doctrine of discovery. Then I moved to the U.S. a few years later, and I always defined myself as a missionary against empire. So I said, I'm going, you know, because I live in the U.S., I'm going to be working in the belly of the best, in the belly of the beast, to fight empire from within. And that was a little arrogant, because even though in 1992 I was fighting, you know, against the doctrine of discovery, I did not make the connections about the fact that I was going to come here as a settler until I was told a couple of years ago in Canada by friends who are doing this work around reconciliation between settlers and natives, who told me, "You are a settler." And I said, "No, I'm not." And they said, "Yes, you are." I said, "No, I'm a privileged immigrant, but I, you know, I'm an immigrant. I'm here, you know, as a social justice fighter." And she said, this woman, a friend of mine, she said, "Well, you're still benefiting from white privilege. You're still benefiting from, you know, all the privileges that come with you being a European, even though you didn't come, or your ancestors didn't come during the conquest. But the conquest is still going on. Coloniality is still part of the genocide." Jim Baer, your storytelling yesterday, the exposure on the hilltop and at the sacred site of the concentration camp, and also the, you know, all the conversations that we've had this weekend have really shook me to my core, and I've it's been such a humbling experience for me. It has changed me and transformed me, and so this is what has really worked. So I want to thank you for having transformed me, and I guess that all of us have been transformed. So thank you.
I'll be the first one to say that I shouldn't be uncomfortable with the silence. I really wasn't. I just mainly wanted to say, first and foremost, happy anniversary to Ched and Elaine. I guess I got to say, you know, I try to reveal this here. I've been married before a couple times, but the couple times I've been married, I've never been married a total of 16 years. So I don't know how the heck people do that, but and it took a few years for me to realize that there was one common denominator in those relationships, and it was me. And I'm working on cleaning up my act, but I think the best information, other than all of it, where I got my eyes open was the first night, Thursday night, when I was here, when they were talking about radical theology and all that other kind of stuff. Because I just have to, before I wasn't going to come here on Thursday, and I was driving down the road, and I got the letter, the email, which is so important. I was here Thursday because John sent out a email reminding us of this, and oh, by the way, there's still time to make it for tonight's meeting. So I thought, well, and you know, who's the first person I see when I come in is John. But I was driving down the road to my house, lived about 2 miles from where I work teaching, and I thought, I got to go there. I got to listen to about radical theology. I for some reason I like that, and has a nice sound. And so while I was driving, you know, I first and foremost, I love Jesus Christ, and I love doing whatever He wants me to do. And I love talking about the Holy Spirit and how He moves in my life and where I see it moving other places. And it was like a Holy Spirit thing, as I'm thinking this thought in my head, That radical theology, it sounds like something I could wrap my head around. I like that. And it was a Holy Spirit nudge that said, well, why don't you do something radical? And none of you really know me that well, but once you get to know me, you'll find out. If somebody said, who's the laziest person you know? And everybody would say, Brian John. He's like, I don't like doing anything. I just like sitting and on somebody else. I got good ideas. I'd like to have you do all them, but I don't want to do them. I just think they're good ideas. And so I was thinking, I'll come here and I'll listen to that. I want to listen to that and see what they have to say. Because another thing I'm doing, was doing, but I've since changed my mind completely since Thursday night and thinking about it, is I was seriously thinking about going to the monastery at St. John's. And after I got here and heard that Thursday night thing about closing yourself away from everything and what is that going to do for you and what is that going to do for... I mean, I'm paraphrasing what you guys said. That's what I got out of it anyway. Maybe God let me hear what I needed to hear. I decided, you know, I don't really need to go there. I can do what I like to do now, and I want to retire, but I never wanted to just retire and go play golf. I just can't stand golf anyway. Or go bowling, because I don't like that either. And I'm Ojibwe Indian. We hunt, fish, and gather. And I hate hunting, and if I never go again, I won't miss any of it. And I absolutely detest fishing. And gathering, we had to do it when I was little, and so I swore that never again would I do any gathering of berries. Unless you invite me over to your house, I'll gather yours all night long. And I do my best hunting and fishing in Walmart, in the meat and section there. That's where I do my stuff. So anyway, it was like, so I want to retire, but I don't really want to retire. And I was driving across the country once in my RV here last summer, and I happened to have it turned on a Catholic station, and so I'm listening to this radio station on a Sunday morning, and they're interviewing this couple of nuns and a priest slash brother, and I'm listening to them and blah blah blah, and when the oldest nun that was on there, and you really couldn't tell how old she was, but I knew she had to have a few years on her when she said she was retired from the Air Force. She was a retired officer. And she didn't want to retire out of anything. She wanted to retire into something. So she went from 20 years of, or plus, roaming around the world with the Air Force as active duty military, and then went to the wherever nuns go. And now she's that full-time and doing her thing. And that's what I want to do. But I like the way they do it here. I like the underground seminary here, and because I believe the word so much, I've learned so much. I bought the economics 72 pager that Ched published, and I'm going to put together some teaching on that. I asked him, and he said, sure you can. And I said, I wouldn't do anything until you okayed what I was doing. He said, well, you don't have to do that. Just go ahead and do it. But I know he was thinking, hey, hell, I can probably sell a couple hundred bucks here. No, not really. I didn't think he thought that. But this is what I wanted to do. I decided this is what I'd want to do, is whatever it is I can do here at this church is cool. So I'll retire out of that and into whatever this is. So I don't know what this is, and don't try to explain it to me. Along with being lazy, I'm kind of dense too. So I know you got a pretty clear picture of it, but I don't have a clue. Actually, I know they don't, because Pastor keeps saying, we change stuff all the time around here. So what they thought was a good idea was, you know, all of a sudden it's not. And so I like that. So if I can teach, if I can preach, if I can play music, if I can, I don't care what it is. I'm just, as soon as I get done with what I got to go up there, I'm heading down here in my RV, and we'll see what happens. So. So, miigwech. Thank you very much.
Hi, everyone. I'm Caleb. It's nice to meet you all. I just kind of wanted to take a second to express two moments of gratitude I've had this weekend, one of which being this really confusing feeling of welcome, because I hear of this story of Jim Bear leading this sacred sites tour and talking about some really horrible things that white people have done and as settlers have done, and hearing about concentration camps and hearing about moving and resettling and taking land and all these lists and lists of things. And then what happens when we first come in but to be blessed with drums and to be offered smudge like that? Talk about radical. You don't need much more example than that. That's hospitality at its core. That's Christ action and every bodhisattva and the great river that runs through all of us. It's all of those things. And I'm so grateful for that radical hospitality. And the second thing is, I'm so grateful to all of you. Like, you all are on fire about this stuff. Thank you. It's nice sometimes to come to a room full of people and hear that you're not the only crazy son of a gun in the world. And and I think a lot of us are feeling kind of tired at the end of the day because of that relentlessness, and I can't think of a better reason to feel tired than having perpetual conversation that can hopefully send us forward in some way. So thank you to those who were from Native tribes that welcomed us. Thank you to the panels for all your wonderful discussions, and thanks to you guys for being here. It's been really inspiring. Cheers.
So first I have a thank you, and then I have a request. So my thank you is, I think I've said to a few people, I've been to a lot of conferences. I've been to a lot of really good conferences. But this might be the only conference, I don't know if I would even consider it a conference, that I feel like I'm going to go home different than when I came. So thank you. And maybe this is greedy to ask this request, especially after all the work you've all done. But I wonder, especially hearing Elaine talk about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada and how far we are from that in this country. Like 48 hours isn't enough. And I wonder if, I mean, this group of people in this space was just so sacred here. I wonder if this same group of people could think about in like 2 years doing like something like a week long and going even deeper. Maybe you've all already thought about that, and I don't want to overwhelm anybody. But I know like I would come back in a heartbeat for 2 weeks if we did a two-week something. And I don't know exactly what that would look like, if it would be all of us together, if we'd have to do our own work as like white settlers separately from, or if we'd do it all at the same time. I don't know, but I would trust your wisdom and request that you maybe give something like that some thought. So thank you.
Could do it in February.
You certainly could.
Yes. All come to the Ventura River watershed. That would be fantastic. That's what you were saying, right?
There are prophecies about this age that we're in from every corner of the earth. And I don't want us to get lost in the grief, even though that's important, because there's a movement started that's unstoppable now, right? We're only going to gain momentum from here. And I didn't know there was this much movement. I was really caught off guard by the number of people that came out and by the energy here. I didn't know what to expect, and you guys have blown me away, and I just want to throw the encouragement back at you all, and don't despair, because this is something that is gaining momentum, and it's been known about and talked about for a long time, and now we and our children are thrusting it forward. So my question for the panel is, do any of you have something to share about that? I've been thinking about it today, and I don't know if there's anything specific, but if you have some words around, you know, the age that we're in and the movement that we're part of, please share that with us.
So if you were up on the hill with me yesterday afternoon, you heard the story of Tesawin, the white buffalo calf woman, and that is a story and prophecy, much like Sierra mentioned, are found speaking of this age all around the world. And I am hopeful because I talk about how each of us have the capacity to transform lives. Some of you have testified to that just even in the last few moments. That tool we have for transformation is the human story. And those of you who have even used that language, transformed, all that's happened this weekend is that you've encountered human story and you've been transformed. And I remember when I first started doing this work of bringing to light, working to bring to light out of the shadows, the story of the indigenous people in this land, in these Twin Cities areas. I had on one of my very early tours a Lutheran minister who's a white man and pastored the ELCA, if I mentioned the church, you would know it already. But he was on one of my tours, and all I did was tell story, which is all I ever do on these tours. It's all I have the capacity to do. And it was maybe 3 months later, he and I were at an event down at the St. Paul River Center, which is a small convention center right in St. Paul, right next to the river. And it was an event to celebrate the river, okay, and sort of St. Paul's reimagining the Mississippi Riverfront and how it might be developed into the future, right? And so there were CEOs of companies casting forth their vision. There was any number of rich people imagining these things. And there was the mayor of St. Paul speaking about the river and about development and speaking in such a way that this is his divine right to cast a vision for the river. And this Lutheran minister, this white Lutheran minister, and I are at the same table. And he turns to me in the middle of the mayor talking. We're in like the center, you know, so he's like kind of being socially rude, right? Because he turns to me, the mayor's still talking, and he says, "After hearing you, I can't listen to this bullshit anymore." And I said, "Excuse me?" He says, "3 months ago, when we were down at the river and hearing that, I cannot listen with the same ears. Prior to that, this would have been awesome because it's economic development for the city I live in. It's moving forward into the future. But where are the Dakota people? Where are the indigenous people casting this vision? And he flat out, he said, you've completely ruined my life. Am I hopeful? I'm hopeful, Sierra, because when story is cast out, it transforms. That's why we tell story. Okay? Books transform, kind of. Apologies to the authors here. But story is the active engagement in human narrative, and it cannot help but transform. If it doesn't transform, you have to work at keeping it away. Because story pervades. The words go out. And as Bob always says, when you tell a story, you speak with your mouth, but your heart fills in the space between the words. And so those of you who stood on that hilltop yesterday afternoon, you know that. Those of you who have ever been up there with me before, you know that. Those of you who have spent any time with this man or these two, you know that. It's a human story. And we are in this time, yes, where it seems like people recognize the crisis and they turn to Indian people. And it's almost like, you know what, there's not as much angst in Indian people because we know that the earth is alive and she will heal. Whether or not you are here, she will heal. And our grandmothers give us that knowledge of how to live in these places, in these spaces. And we're willing to share, if you're willing to accept. I don't know if that quite answers your question, but...
Thank you, Sierra, for that. The word, the question itself is hopeful. I'm thinking about a couple of things. One is the lesson from Easter Island. What we have left of that island are this massive stone monuments. But we know from archaeological evidence that the only way that they could make stones that size was to have furnaces, massive furnaces that required the burning of a whole bunch of trees. It was mostly a forested island. And then two groups emerged that were competing with each other. It's a fascinating story. You can read about it in Jared Diamond's book, Collapse, which is his sequel to Guns, Germs, and Steel. Both books are part of our seminary curriculum. And they were basically saying, my God is bigger than your God, and my daddy can beat up your daddy. And so they were in this competition for building bigger and bigger stone monuments. The trees were habitat for the food on the island, but the trees also provided the trunks for the canoes because there were no natural beaches. They had to go out into the ocean for fishing. And the question that Diamond asked is, what were they thinking when they cut down the last tree? Did they have any idea that they were basically committing collective suicide? A number of years ago, Minnesota Vikings was on the cusp of going to the Super Bowl. And our son, maybe he was like 7 or 8 years old at the time, was a huge Minnesota Vikings fan. He didn't know any better in those days. And just, it was just some little thing, and we lost the chance to go to the Super Bowl. As some of our church members left our home to go to their own home, our son had his face on the carpet in our family room and like wept for 20 minutes. So how does an 8-year-old grieve this deeply for a professional football team, of all things? And this is how easily captive we are, how deeply we can feel about trivial things like football teams and national flags and corporate power and things like that. Why is our world being destroyed so actively, so fast? There's this thing called the Forbes 100 Wealthiest People. Do you know about this? There's like a Fortune 500, biggest companies. There's also a Forbes 100. Do you have any idea how much these billionaires, multi-billionaires, compete to be number one, or at least in the top 10? And if they used to be in the top 25, but then they drop to the bottom 25, they're devastated. I mean, they are devastated like my son was devastated at that Vikings loss. And they will cut down every last tree to make it to the top 25, to the top 10, to be number one. It is some kind of strange metric that we create, and then we'll invest our whole life, and we can destroy the entire planet if we can somehow tell ourselves that we made it, that we're special, that we're a winner. We're, I believe, in that moment, that Easter Island moment. We're about to cut down the last few trees that we have and commit collective suicidal self-genocide, basically. And how do we get off this narrative, right? Did the people on Easter Island just need to care more about trees and fish and the environment? Or did they also need to like have a whole new story about who they are, what they're worth, and what life is about? I think our narrative, the strange stories we have told ourselves about what life is about, is what's killing us. And that's why I think this story thing that Jim Bear and Native people have always been about is not a minor thing. We treat story like children's fairy tale kind of thing. We did that when we were children, and then we grow up to deal with the real world. But the real world is crazy madness storytelling. It's like storytelling from horror books. And we need to tell a better story. And when human beings are raised with better stories, we're going to create a better earth. I don't know if it's too late for the human species on this planet, but I know we've got to tell better stories. And the church, for me anyway, is the place where we can tell a different story. And it's all there in the Bible if we would just read it through a different lens. And just another small thing, I was having a conversation with one of our participants today about invasive species and the zebra mussels that are taking over so many lakes and rivers. And I wonder if like white colonial settlers are like zebra mussels. Are all white people just one invasive species? So what am I, Asian carp? You know? We're trying to keep Asian carp out of the Mississippi River here, past Minneapolis, which would go right up to Lake Itasca if we let it. So really, like all of us are invasive species on this continent. And are we going to choke the oxygen out of the water so that we eventually all die out? Maybe. Maybe that's the only way for this invasive species to disappear so that Earth can heal. Or how do we cross-fertilize with the native habitat, the native people, the native watershed, and be a constructive living organism, right? And that's what I mean, why the work in our own self, our own body, is so critically important. We can embody invasive species, or we can embody habitat and ecosystem. And so the work of transformation in ourselves is, everything, in my opinion, is at stake over that.
Hi, my name's Christy, and I'm so thankful to be here. I've been looking forward to this for at least 6 months. And it has brought together so much internal story work that I've been working on for many years. Having moved to Minnesota 5 years ago and learning through Minnesota stories about the indigenous people, this place. It's an exciting integration to be sitting next to Sierra, whose parents went to the same church as my parents in New Mexico and are friends with each other. And I'm really struck by the metaphors of disease and illness, and this Chad just said this, the terminal diagnosis, is that, yeah. So I'm doing an internship as a hospital chaplain right now, and I walk down these halls from the ICU and the emergency department after talking with these families or a patient, and just think, oh my God, what is wrong with us? What is wrong? You know, Jim, those stories you're talking about, oh my God, I see them, I hear them. I was talking with Dana about this earlier today. We are so sick. And we need to get the family together, we need to get the kin together to have a serious conversation about what are we going to do. Sharing these conversations, it's a beautiful metaphor because I've been a part of these family conversations at the bedside as the terminal diagnosis has been given. And, you know, a man will say, I really haven't been paying attention to this God stuff. Tell me what's going to happen now. Tell me what's going to happen now that I'm dying. And tell me what I should have been paying attention to all these years. Anyway, so much integration, so much hope. And I'm so thankful for the solidarity of a community to be walking with in this journey.
Hi, I'm Craig. I'm an ELCA pastor and also recently started on the staff of the Minneapolis Area Synod and one of the assistants to the bishop. And so we were thrilled to be able to be some of the supporters of this conference. And this is one of the first conferences I've gone to now as part of the sort of institution or the administration rather than a pastor in a local church. I live just a mile south of here in Northeast Minneapolis and was pastor of a church there for a little over 12 and a half years. So I, unlike probably most of you, I've been dipping in and out of the conference. I had three other events today and a couple others tomorrow to tend to as part of my job. But that's offered me the opportunity to really think about this and try to work it into some framework, like in jolting fashion, as I would come here for a plenary or workshop and then I'd leave to go do something and then come back and be both challenged and enriched here. And so just to you folks who have just done amazing work in your presentations and writings and the history of coming to this point in this space, there are a lot of, I know, leaders of faith communities who really want to lead in this area as well, but struggle with how and how to develop a core group of people to do it with. And so I would just say, don't give up on us, leaders of sort of mainline denominational churches. We see what is happening to God's creation. We see the need to reimagine and have new narratives. But when you have books with liturgies and you have rites that you follow, it takes an enormous amount of energy. And we want to do it, but we need prayer and commitment and collaboration. So I know that our bishop, Ann Svenningsen, is deeply committed to this, as are we as staff, and don't give up on us. We really want to be about this work. So thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah. And thank you to the Synod for the support. The short list of things that I've observed that I think worked here, and my experience tells me work in any space, but are often lacking, are things like taking on deadly serious topics with a measure of grace and humor, right? And Pastor Jin is a great example of this. You know, he can crack a few jokes, poke a little fun, and then, you know, pull out the dagger of analysis, right? It's a discursive grace that is learned, and is something that I think is one of the things that makes these sorts of conversations better, more viable. I think, and Jim Bear has spoken to this time and time again, and I hope we walk away with it very firmly implanted in our hearts and minds, the centering of story and the decentering of whiteness are two of the things I think that have made this gathering atypical and profound. And let's be observing and learning, right? That's what permaculture is all about, observing what works. I think the ecumenical polyculture of us as a community really, really works, because there's not a critical mass of any one denominational group that could start getting anxious about their institutional drama. But we're all coming from various traditions, but we're coming together in common cause. In many respects, we have more in common with each other and the points of conversation than maybe we do with some of the drama in our respective traditions, and that's a good thing. We need to have more spaces like that, it seems to me. And I also want to not overlook the home economics of this last 24 hours, that food is always important, but there's been a nice diversity of kinds of food, and there's been sitting at family table, and there's been attentiveness toward utensils, and we have a bookstore and a barista. Things like that actually help create a family, a household space where the serious family meeting can happen. Can't emphasize too much the role of the nonverbal, and that ranges from dance and music to visual art, to silence. The dialectic of tears and laughter has flowed really freely here, and both are important. We're not having the conversation we need to have unless the tears are flowing, but also that we can laugh at our predicament a little bit and not take ourselves so seriously, which is part of whiteness, I think. Those are some of the aspects that actually are a little atypical of your average conference, which tends to be very managed and controlled and locked down. And I hope we can take away some of these lessons. Above all, the quality that has, I think, a lot of us settler folk have experienced in the last 48 hours have been what Calvinists and Lutherans call unearned grace. And I'm talking about what a number of our white sisters and brothers have named. I just can't believe I could step into this space and be welcomed by Native people and be embraced. That, friends, you actually have a theology for that, right? White people and white theologians talk a lot about unearned grace and actually have very little experience of it. And this is, when unearned grace breaks out, all sorts of space opens up for being able to step out of some of the worst pathological anxieties. Those are just some observations that let us be about cultivating and curating those sorts of conversational habits. And again, thank you. The gratitude is a really important practice, and it's really flowed. That's part of the love fest. We're all just so doggone grateful to be here. That's as it should be. Gratitude also makes a lot of things possible. So let those be some learnings for us. And I think maybe it's time to turn it. Okay, Elaine wants to say one word.
I want the last word. Sierra, I'm still thinking of your question. And I realized that, Jim Bear, when you began, you talked about the women that came up to you and shared with you, and you wondered about whether we were recognizing the divine feminine of the earth. And I thought of our conversation in the trauma workshop, and I was gonna go there, but I didn't have time, where responding to crisis, it's been thought for a long time that it's fight, flight, or freeze. This is very new. They're finding that when women are faced with crisis, terror, our reaction, and I don't have quite the right phrase, but sister care is what comes to mind. We go to our loved ones and we care for them. And they're finding that the chemical oxytocin, when women are in labor and giving birth, that is the chemical that is released in us to give us the strength to be able to birth. That same chemical they're finding is released when we are faced with crisis or terror, when we run to protect and care for our loved ones. Sierra, your act of giving that beautiful shawl to these two brothers was an act of sister care. And so, women, let's rise up and be the sister care for each other, for our beloved community, and work to share and care for each other.
Can we give one more hand for those who have been before us all week in these plenary sessions?